welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper with the Public Policy Channel, and today I'm pleased to welcome Suja Thomas, who is co-author with Sandra Sperino of Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law, which is new this year from Oxford University Press. Suja, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So before we turn our attention to this new book, I wonder if you might tell our listeners a little bit about your background and your previous work, and then perhaps a little bit about what it is that led you to this particular project.
Sure. I'm a professor at the University of Illinois College of Law, and my previous project in the last year was I wrote a book entitled The Missing American Jury that was published by Cambridge University Press. And in that book, I point out that juries decide few cases, actually less than 4% of criminal cases and less than 1% of civil cases. And on the criminal side, this is mainly due to procedures like plea bargaining that force many criminal defendants into pleas. And on the civil side, part of the story is related to procedures before trial and after trial, where judges question the evidence that was presented by plaintiffs. So these two sides of the story are something that I talk about in The Missing American Jury.
Mm-hmm. In Unequal, you home in explicitly on employment discrimination law, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Employers actually request dismissals, oftentimes on summary judgment, this procedure that is before trial, and judges actually dismiss over 70% of discrimination cases in whole or in part when employers make these requests for dismissal. And as you said, we hone in on this and what is going on in these cases.
So why don't we, for folks who may not be familiar, there are three principal places, as you identify them, sort of in law where we find language that specifically relates to employment discrimination. Can you just lay out for folks sort of what the law says in maybe each of those three places, and then we can start talking about what happens when those cases get to judges?
Yeah, and I actually am not quite totally sure I'm knowing what you're referring to. I know, you know, we have Congress has...
Well, I'm thinking Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
Oh, okay, yeah. So in Title VII, Congress has set forth really general language protecting employees from discrimination on a number of bases, including not being discriminated against based on their race, their sex, their national origin, their religion. And we have age discrimination statutes as well, that protect against discrimination on the basis of age. We have a statute that also protects against discrimination on the basis of disability. And so we have a number of statutes that have been enacted by Congress so that we hope that because of those, employers will not discriminate. But where they do, the idea is that plaintiffs can bring suits in court and challenge the actions that the employers have taken.
And so now plaintiffs do in fact bring suits, right?
They do. They do. And they need to first go to sometimes a state agency, sometimes the federal agency, the EEOC, and file a charge of discrimination. It's an unusual procedure that occurs in discrimination cases where you actually have to go to an administrative agency first. But ultimately, you can go to court, and plaintiffs will file cases in court, sometimes on their own as pro se plaintiffs and sometimes with lawyers.
And, you know, the larger argument that you make in the book and walk us through sort of how this happens is that, as you said earlier, judges dismiss an extraordinarily large percent of these cases before they even get to trial. So can you talk a little, what is it how is it that judges are supposed to make decisions in these particular kinds of cases about whether there is merit for moving a case forward to trial or not?
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting because we obviously see in the media a lot of mention of sexual harassment, race discrimination. And, you know, at some point, I think during President Obama's time, people kind of talked about whether or not we still have race discrimination, for example. And I think sometimes people thought there wasn't any sexual harassment or sexual discrimination. But it's very apparent, right nowadays, that that's all the case, that there is, that remains discrimination in our society. And as you mentioned, we have these laws that Congress has enacted to protect people against discriminating. But there is a procedure that is particularly used by judges, where judges can decide that they think that a reasonable jury could not find for the plaintiff who brings the case. And if they think that, they can dismiss the case. And so this happens, as I said, in a good number of employment discrimination cases. And the really, I think, astounding thing about this is that the facts of the cases where judges are dismissing cases can be incredibly blatant in terms of the discrimination that occurs.
So can you, offer lots of examples in the book of these kinds of instances. Can you share a few with listeners so they get a sense of the kinds of decisions that judges are making about cases that they don't think warrant even going as far as trial?
Sure. One of the cases that we mentioned in the book is a case where there was sexual harassment alleged by someone who worked for the sheriff's department as a deputy sheriff and investigator against a supervisor. And she alleged a number of actions by that supervisor, including that the supervisor tried to kiss her at a Christmas party, called her, I'll have to use some language that is not the best language, but called her a frigid bitch when she refused. He showed up at places she was staking out and talked about what she looked like. Showed up at her house drunk, told her that her son that he loved her, said that if she walked into her room, he'd get an erection, picked her up at the office over his head, chased her around the office, asked her over the phones whether she was dressed or naked. Anyway, it goes on and on and on, and the judge in this case said that the conduct was not that frequent. Over 4 years, there were only 16 specific instances. Most were offensive utterances. They weren't, most of the time it wasn't that he touched her. Only three times did he touch her or attempt to touch her. And much of it involved horseplay. So the judge and then the appellate court affirmed what the judge said. And you know, we have case after case where you have facts like this, including, you know, the sexual harassment cases, racial harassment cases. We have racial harassment cases where the KKK was used, noose was used, the N-word was used, and a judge says this is not enough to constitute where a reasonable jury could find that there is harassment. And we're not even saying in these cases that there are what the jury should find. Right. We're just saying that the case should go to a jury and a jury should decide.
And you know, keeping in mind that I am not a lawyer, but my understanding and my understanding from your book is that judges are meant to presume that for the purposes of determining whether a case goes to trial, that these facts are in fact true, correct?
That's right. This procedure of summary judgment that I've actually written quite a bit about, it's supposed to be the case that there are no the facts are essentially accepted as true, and if you put the law on top of the facts, there is a claim or there is no claim. But what's happened in these factually intensive cases, like employment discrimination cases and other civil rights cases, is that judges try to say that there's no factual issue, it's just a legal question. And so in the case that I just mentioned, they'll say, oh, well, it's a legal question. I am determining that this is not severe or pervasive enough to constitute harassment, and therefore I'm deciding this legal question and I'm throwing the case out. And it's just not a legal question. It's right. Clearly a factual question that people should decide, juries should decide together what they think about these allegations of discrimination and whether or not they think that the person should prevail.
So you talk throughout the book both about a number of sort of formal doctrines that judges use in order to arrive at these determinations of dismissal, or in later parts of the process in even changing the verdict as it's come back from the jury. Can you talk? It's presumably there is some kind of legal rationale at work for this behavior of judges. Can you walk through a little bit about the kinds of let's call them excuses that jurists have used for either dismissing these cases or in some instances overturning verdicts when they do get to jury?
Sure. The first example that I gave you, what they do is the United States Supreme Court has said, okay, here we have the statutory language that says you cannot discriminate because of sex. And then the United States Supreme Court said, okay, we recognize that sexual harassment is a form of discrimination, but we think in order to actually win on sexual harassment, you have to show us that this is so severe or pervasive that it actually alters your terms and conditions or conditions of employment and create a hostile or abusive working environment. So in that case, that first case that I mentioned, the court says, yeah, it doesn't meet that standard. We think it doesn't meet that standard. So that's one way that this is done. But there's literally about 20 or so ways that courts do this. And another way is they'll say, a discriminatory remark is what's called a stray remark. And so there was a case, and what that refers to, first of all, is that the remark was too remote in time from the decision that is alleged to be discriminatory. So a remark was made, let's say, in January that was discriminatory from the supervisor to the employee. But then in June, that's when the supervisor fired the employee, and there was no discriminatory mark at that time, and so therefore the supervisor wasn't discriminating. And a particular example is there was a teacher who was starting in a job, and the superintendent said to him that he was black, and he was a coach, and he said, he had had problems in the past with black coaches, and if there was another problem, no matter what it was, he would do his best to get rid of him from day one. And he also had said, the superintendent had said in the same conversation, he had bad luck with black men working in the town. So there had been complaints against the particular new teacher/coach, there were some complaints, and whether they were legitimate or not, I can't tell you. But they decided not to go forward with recommending him to renew his contract, and the position was filled by a white female. And so what the court said in this in its decision was that there was overwhelming evidence supporting the legitimate justification in deciding not to renew the contract. And so the comments could just be viewed as stray remarks that did not have any bearing on whether or not there was a discrimination in this case. And so so the case was dismissed. And even though there was explicit evidence of discrimination by the superintendent, this was ignored, and the court said, we don't find this persuasive. So we have case after case after case where there's explicit evidence of discrimination, and the case gets dismissed. Again, I emphasize that we're not saying there was discrimination or there wasn't discrimination. We're saying this case goes to a jury, and the jury is the best body to decide, not a single judge.
So I am assuming that a disproportionate number of these judges are white and male, yes?
That's true. There are, different stats at different points in time. The latest statistics that I've seen are something like, I think it's something like 60-something percent of federal judges are men, and 70-something percent are white. The most important point is that the federal judiciary and the state judiciary as well, but we really talk about the federal judiciary in the book, it doesn't map what the general population is. Right. And so while a jury population isn't going to exactly map the general population, it's going to better represent the general population than the judiciary.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because that's, you know, one of the ways in which allowing these cases to go to a jury might create a different outcome, might not, but might. And that simply that you would have surely greater diversity. Well, one would hope greater diversity, not surely, greater diversity on a jury than you get in when you look at the federal judiciary. What are the other virtues of allowing these cases to go to juries so that we might wind up with better decisions?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I like to talk about, and it kind of goes back to the first book, is that, you know, we chose the jury to decide. So in the Constitution, we have the Seventh Amendment, and the Seventh Amendment provides for a civil jury to decide certain cases. And it's civil juries were supposed to decide cases with monetary damages. And so we trusted juries to decide these types of disputes. And even if we get into cases involving, let's say, an unreasonable search by the government of a person, you know, again, back in the day, you could sue the government and the government would have to give you damages. Right now, it's the case that case could be dismissed. And a judge could just say, oh, you know, you don't get a chance to have a jury decide. But I think it's important to have the community come together and decide these important questions. I think it's important, one, for just participation purposes, but also for purposes of actually having a fair result for the person who is bringing their case.
So you know, to hear you tell it, these judges are engaging in improper and inappropriate behavior. I'm not qualified to judge whether it rises to the level of illegality, but it seems to me clear that they are violating the intent of a whole host of federal laws. Is that a fair read? And if so, how does that happen and how does it persist?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think over time, what has happened is that we've become more accepting of a shift of authority away from juries deciding. And I don't mean we as a general population, because the general population doesn't know that this is going on. And one of the goals of my first book and also for the second book is to kind of expose what's happening. So originally, the Supreme Court itself was more protective of the jury. And over time, it has become less protective of the jury. And over time, we have seen of course, juries decide fewer cases, but I think over time we've also seen a more willingness of judges to say, you know, we think there's only one possible answer here, and as a result, we're going to dismiss this case. The thing that we should keep in mind, though, is judges often, and I've heard them say this over and over again, judges will say that juries are actually very good decision makers. That they trust them, that they are very careful, so there's this odd situation where you see judges and you hear judges talking about juries in this way, but at the same time, they take these very factually intensive cases away from juries and use these different doctrines and inferences that, to me, don't make a lot of sense. To take these cases away. And so I think that a lot of judges on the district court level, that is the lower court mm-hmm. level, in the trial court level, I think that they feel that they have to dismiss these cases. A lot of judges, I think, see what the appellate courts have said, and they see certain facts from certain cases, and they say, well, if that's not enough, to show harassment, then my case isn't enough to show harassment. And so I think that a lot of district court judges, trial court judges, believe that they are compelled to dismiss certain cases. But some places are just, you know, worse than others. And, you know, the Atlanta courts, are not and this may be again, because of the appellate court, but I'm not sure of that. But the Atlantic courts have even worse statistics than the statistics I mentioned earlier. Over 80% of cases are dismissed. I think last month, every case that came out, there was summary judgment granted in employment discrimination cases, something that I heard anecdotally. So I think it's a multifaceted question and answer to say why we are where we are today. But part of what we're trying to do with this book is to expose something that people really have not paid attention to.
And I want to turn in just a moment to what we do about it. But I guess I'm you know, it's you know, in the context of this conversation, it is impossible not to have recent allegations against Harvey Weinstein, and then subsequently lots and lots of other high profile people seems to have opened up a floodgate of sorts of not exclusively, but mostly women coming forward and reporting past incidences of assault, abuse, or harassment. And, you know, in many instances, if we are to believe that testimony, that in many cases is coming from lots and lots of sources, this has been longstanding, pervasive, discriminatory behavior that in some companies has been going on literally for decades. I mean, I guess the question that comes to mind is, has it been able to persist in part because employers know that the legal system so favors them?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I don't know the answer to that. I would be speculating.
Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable speculating?
But I kind of feel comfortable speculating. I think that if you know that if someone brings a claim of sexual harassment and that they're unlikely to win that case, that in some contexts that you may feel more comfortable allowing it to continue. But I will say that in a lot of the contexts that have come up recently where people are famous or have a lot of power, I think that in some of those contexts, I think that that is more to do with power and what the companies are willing to do. And I think that obviously this was going on for a long time with Harvey Weinstein, and it went on a long time because lots of people allowed it to go on because Harvey Weinstein was a very powerful person. And I think we see this in other contexts without naming names. You know, we see this in many other contexts, different powerful people in our society who have been allowed to get away with this for many, many years before anyone was called out about it, or at least in any public setting. I'm sure people were called out, but not necessarily publicly. So I think a lot of this has to do with power outside of this issue of whether or not, you know, the case will actually be won at trial.
We've talked a lot about sexual harassment. I want to sort of turn just briefly and talk about racial discrimination. And you make reference a couple of times to the work of Diva Pager, who's a sociologist. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the findings of her research, just as a way of communicating to listeners who may not know the evidence that we have available of just how pervasive racial discrimination continues to be in the American workplace.
Yeah, and you're referring specifically to the callback.
I am, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And I don't have the stats right here before me, so you may be able to actually say something more about this. But the basic gist is that there was a study that was done that they generated resumes and they sent these resumes to different cities and they had African-American names versus white names on these resumes, and people had criminal records versus not having criminal records, and One of the statistics shows that, you know, you were more likely, if you were white, to receive a callback, even if you had a criminal record, than if you were black and you did not have a criminal record. So there's significant discrimination that continues in the workplace, which is shown by this study. And
other studies. And that sort of that work has been replicated, I don't know how many different times now, by Pager and by a whole host of other scholars as well. And part of why I bring it up is that I think it's all to the good that at least at this particular moment, we are paying attention to sexual discrimination and assault and harassment in the workplace. And I think the Me Too campaign on social media has been, I think, eye-opening for lots of men who perhaps have been unaware of how widespread and common an experience of sexual harassment in the workplace is for lots and lots of women. I think that my feeling over the last couple of weeks is I worry that we lose sight of the racial discrimination aspect of it as well, and how pervasive and troubling that is. So that if we've got, you know, sort of if we've got judges erecting their own kinds of barriers for their own kinds of reasonings for these cases to come to trial, and for there to be some sort of consequence to these actions, I think that we run the risk of perpetuating injustice and discrimination across a whole host of dimensions. So Suja, so what do we do about this? how do we start to make progress in the other direction?
Sure. One of the things that my co-author and I, Sandra Sbrino, are doing is, you know, we have formed a committee and we are getting a lot of important players to join our committee to discuss how we can make change. And specifically, one of the changes that needs to occur is, I think, and both of us think, there needs to be congressional change. We need Congress to confirm that there should be a broad interpretation of the statutes, and that we should specifically dismantle these doctrines and inferences that have been created, some by the Supreme Court, but mostly by the lower courts. So that's one of the things that has to happen. And I think it's actually probably the most important thing that has to happen is actually having some statutory language that changes how we view the employment discrimination laws and how the courts are supposed to actually interpret the employment discrimination laws. I think that other things that we can do include actually having in the courts encouraging litigants to kind of emphasize the really broad language. I kind of mentioned really briefly that there's really broad language in all of these statutes, but that language has really been restricted by the courts. And then I just think that we need to inform the public about the dismissal of these types of claims. I think that there'll be interest if people hear about this. And I've been doing some work on that front. I worked on a project with TED and put together a short video that illustrates the jury problem more generally, but also the employment discrimination aspect of this. But I think that all three of these things, congressional change, a change within the courts, in the absence of congressional change, or at least until congressional change, having the courts actually try to make change, and then also informing the public, I think all of these are important to trying to get us to the point where Congress actually wanted us to be, I think, from the 1964 Title VII Act.
We've been speaking with Suja Thomas, who is co-author with Sandra Sbrino of Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law, which is out this year from Oxford University Press. So, Suja, what are you working on, or what's the next project?
Yeah, as I've talked about, I have a real interest in the jury, and I've written about the jury in the past, and this project itself, the Unequal book, has a jury angle to it as well. And so I'm really interested in increasing the number of jury trials, and I've been writing and thinking about plea bargaining, as I mentioned before earlier, especially because of this idea that many, many people plead guilty because of the differences in sentences that they receive if they plead guilty versus if they go to a jury trial and are convicted. They receive a much more severe sentence if they take the jury trial and are convicted. And this results in some even innocent people pleading guilty. And so there are 10% of the people who have been found innocent actually pled guilty. And so I've been writing and thinking about plea bargaining and its problems, and I'm going to continue to do that. And then another thing I'm really interested in is about juveniles. And juveniles right now do not have juries decide if they lose their liberty. And I think that I'm going to be looking at whether, in fact, they should have a constitutional right to have a jury decide. I don't. My instinct, but I don't have a definitive answer, is that juveniles should be treated no differently than any other person whose liberty is being taken. And I certainly, so far, don't see anything in the Constitution that convinces me otherwise. So I'm interested in that topic as well.
Thank you. I'm Stephen Pimper with the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network. We have been speaking with Suja Thomas about her new book, Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Suja, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today.
Thank you.